Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Big Show, the classic account of World War II aerial combat, by Pierre Klosterman, narrated by Julian Elfer. Forward, by Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Sir John Slessor, GCB, DSO, MC. If anyone has ever doubted that the French Air Force can produce flying crews of first-class quality, let them get this book. As a fighter pilot and junior commander with a record of 420 operational sorties, first in the famous Alsace Squadron of the Free French Air Force in Britain, and then with RAF units, Pierre Klosterman was second to none. His book is first class, a modest, unflinching record of the real thing. No false glamour, no bravado, no glossing over nor undue exaggeration of the grim facts of air warfare as all operational pilots know them. As he says himself, it is a record of the daily life of every fighter pilot, in a wide variety of jobs, sweeps and bomber escorts over France in 43, close defence of the fleet base at Scapa, beating up V1 sites, the Normandy landing and the land-air war on the continent right through to the bitter end. It is a magnificent story and makes one proud not only of those French boys who fought so gallantly and gaily with us, but of the Royal Air Force with which they served. If ever we have to fight again, which God forbid, it will be good to remember that l'Armée de l'air is alongside us. With good men and true like Klosterman and his friend Jacques Romlager, Mouchotte and Martel, Boudier and de Saxe, and the hundreds of other gallant Frenchmen who shared our trials and our triumphs in those grim years. Preface. For 4 years, my parents and I, their only child, were separated by many thousands of miles. Between London and Brazzaville, the mails were erratic, and any reference in letters to military matters was heavily censored. It was possible to send them a monthly air letter, but that was too cramped for any description of my life in England with the Free French and the RAF. Yet I did want to make my father and mother understand this new life and the mingled feelings it aroused, a life that was unforeseen, often harsh, but deeply satisfying. I wanted them to live it with me, day by day, even if I did not come back to describe it myself. So every evening I used to write down for them the events of the day in a fat Air Ministry notebook stamped GR. In an old envelope, stuck to the cover, I put my will. It was rather an absurd gesture, for General de Gaulle's mercenaries had no goods and chattels to dispose of except their faith in France and their uncertain dreams of home. On the flyleaf I wrote, "In case I should be killed or posted missing, I want this book to be sent to my father, Captain Jacques Klosterman, French Headquarters, Brazzaville, 10-3-1942. This notebook went with me everywhere, crumpled by the weight of my parachute in the cockpit, stained with tea in the mess, or beside me at dispersal during the long, dull hours of readiness. From the Orkneys to Cornwall, from Kent to Scotland, from Normandy to Denmark, through Belgium, Holland and Germany, these notes, by the end of the war they filled 3 books, were always with me. Fate, so cruel to most of my friends, decreed that I should survive 420 sorties and that one day I should be able to tell my father, in my own words, the story of those 4 years. The notebooks remained unread for 2 years. In that time, with the other few survivors of the Free French Air Force, I had the painful task of visiting the families of our friends who had not come back and giving them the bitter consolation of hearing of their sons' deeds. We also met a number of Frenchmen who had no idea of what had happened on the other side of the Channel and who, in some cases, didn't want to learn. But equally we knew that there were many who were trying to find out, in the hope perhaps of being reminded of their own hopes and loyalties. It is for them that this book is published. Change the dates and a few minor details, and it is a record of the daily life of every fighter pilot. Any of my comrades could produce similar episodes by looking through his logbooks. I ask one not to expect a work of literature. I simply jotted down day by day the impressions, the fleetingly caught incidents so sharply imprinted on my memory. It would require a remarkable talent to reproduce with truth and at the same time with literary grace the life of a fighter pilot in the last war. It is precisely because they are true, because they were written in the flush of action, that I have made no attempt to retouch these notes. Pierre Klostermann. Part 1. Pilot with the Alsace Squadron. Operational Training Unit in Wales. 1942. The high Welsh hills, half drowned in mist, glided to left and right of the railway line. We had passed Birmingham, Wolverhampton and Shrewsbury buried in greasy soot. Without exchanging a word, Jacques and I gazed indifferently at the depressing landscape, washed by an incessant drizzle, the dirty, enervating mining towns crawling up the valleys, each one crushed by a pall of grey smoke, anchored to the housetops, so dense that the wind, blowing in icy gusts, could not move it. Our fellow passengers gazed curiously at our navy blue, gold-button French uniforms. The pilot's brevet of the Armée de l'air gleamed proudly on our breasts, with the wings of the RAF over our left pockets. Barely a fortnight before, we had still been pilots under training at the RAF College at Cranwell, dragging round manuals on navigation and armaments and thick books full of notes. All that was only a memory now. In a few hours, perhaps, we would be flying a Spitfire, thus clearing the last hurdle that separated us from the great arena. A few minutes more and we reached Rednal, number 61 OTU, for a conversion course on Spitfires before a squadron posting. Suddenly, Jacques pressed his face to the window. "Look, Pierre, there are our Spitfires." Sure enough, as the train slowed down alongside an airfield, a damp ray of sunshine succeeded in piercing the fog, revealing 20 or so aircraft lined up along a strip of tarmac. The great day had come. It had snowed all night and the airfield was dazzling white beneath the blue sky. Heavens, how good to be alive. I filled my lungs with the icy air and felt the snow crunch under my feet, soft and yielding like an oriental carpet. It brought back many memories, the first snow I had seen for so long. At the door of the flight hut, where you shelter between flights, my instructor was waiting for me, smiling. "How do you feel?" "Okay, sir," I replied, trying to hide my emotion. All my life I shall remember my first contact with the Spitfire. The one I was going to fly bore the markings TO-S. Before putting on my parachute, I stopped a moment to gaze at it. The clean lines of the fuselage, the beautifully streamlined Rolls-Royce engine, a real thoroughbred. "You've got her for 1 hour. Good luck." This Thunderbolt was mine for an hour. 60 intoxicating minutes. I tried to remember my instructor's advice. Everything seemed so confused. I strapped myself in, trembling, adjusted my helmet, and still dazed by the mass of instruments, dials, contacts, levers, which crowded on one another, all vital, and which one's fingers must not fail to touch at the psychological moment, I got ready for the decisive test. Carefully, I went through the cockpit drill, murmuring the ritual phrase. BTFCPPUR. Brakes, trim, flaps, contacts, pressure, in the pneumatic system, petrol, undercarriage, and radiator. Everything was all set. The mechanic closed the door behind me, and there I was, imprisoned in this metal monster, which I had got to control. A last glance. "All clear?" "Contact." I manipulated the hand pumps and the starter buttons. The air screw began to revolve slowly and suddenly with a sound like thunder. The engine fired. The exhausts vomited long blue flames enveloped in black smoke while the aircraft began to shudder like a boiler under pressure. When the chocks were removed, I opened the radiator wide, for these liquid-cooled engines overheat very rapidly, and I taxied very carefully over to the runway, cleared by snow ploughs, jet black and dead straight in the white landscape. "Tudor 26, you may scramble now, you may scramble now." Over the radio, the control tower authorized me to take off. My heart was thumping in my ribs. I swallowed the lump in my throat, lowered my seat, and with a clammy hand I slowly opened the throttle. At once I felt myself swept up by a cyclone. Snatches of advice came back to me. "Don't stick the nose too far forward." In front of me there was only a slight clearance between the ground and the tips of the enormous airscrew, which was going to absorb all the power from the engine. Timidly, I eased the stick forward, and with a jolt that glued me to the back of my seat, the Spitfire started forward, then moved faster and faster while the airfield swept by on either side with increasing speed. Keep her straight. I ruddered frantically to check incipient swings. Suddenly, holding my breath, and as if by magic, I found myself airborne. The railway line passed by like a flash. I was vaguely aware of some trees and houses which disappeared indistinctly behind me. I quickly raised the undercarriage, closed the transparent hood of my cockpit, throttled back, and adjusted the airscrew pitch for cruising. Phew. Drops of sweat ran down my forehead. But instinctively, my limbs reacted like the well-regulated levers of an automaton. The long, tedious months of training had prepared my muscles and reflexes for just this minute. How light she was on the controls. The slightest pressure with hand or foot and the machine leapt into the sky. Good heavens, where am I? The speed was such that the few seconds which had elapsed had been enough to take me half a dozen miles from the airfield. The black runway was no more than a streak of soot on the horizon. Timidly, I hazarded a turn, passed over my base again and turned to left and right. I eased the stick slightly and I climbed 10,000 feet in the twinkling of an eye. Gradually, the speed went to my head and I got bolder. Moving the throttle the fraction of an inch was enough to unleash the engine. I decided to try a dive. Gently, I eased the stick forward. 300, 350, 400 miles per hour. The ground seemed to be hurtling towards me in a terrifying way. Scared by the speed, I instinctively moved the stick back, and suddenly my head was driven into my shoulders, a leaden weight pressed my backbone down and crushed me into my seat and my eyes blurred. Like a steel ball falling on a marble block, the Spitfire had bounced on the elastic air and, as straight as a rod, had shot up into the sky. As soon as I had recovered from the effects of my centrifugal force, I hastened to throttle back, as I had no oxygen and the machine was still climbing. Over the radio I heard Control calling me back. Christmas. An hour already. Everything seemed to have happened in 1 second. Now I had to land. I opened the radiator wide, throttled back, changed to fine pitch, opened my hood, raised the seat, and began my approach. Once again I started to panic. The enormous engine in front of me, with its broad exhaust pipes, blotted out the whole runway. Blinded, my head kept in by the terrific pressure of the air, I was a prisoner in my cockpit. I lowered the undercarriage and the flaps. The runway drew near at frightening speed. I would never succeed in putting her down. The airfield seemed to be getting simultaneously narrower and closer. Stick back, back, desperately. The machine touched down with a loud metallic jolt which reverberated in the fuselage and I felt her awkwardly rolling on the tarmac. A touch of left brake, then a touch of right, and the Spitfire came to a standstill at the end of the runway. The throb of the engine ticking over was like the beating of a winded racehorse's flanks. My instructor jumped up on the wing, helped me off with my parachute, smiling at my pale, drawn face. I took a couple of steps, staggered, and had to hold onto the fuselage.
Good show. You see? Nothing to worry about.
All the same, if only he knew how proud I felt. At last I had flown a Spitfire. How beautiful the machine seemed to me, and how alive, a masterpiece of harmony and power, even as I saw her now, motionless. Softly, as one might caress a woman's cheeks, I ran my hand over the aluminium of her wings, cold and smooth like a mirror, the wings which had borne me. Going back to the hut, my parachute on my back, I turned again and dreamt of the day when, in a squadron, I would have a Spitfire of my own to take into combat, which would hold my life within the narrow confines of its cockpit, and which I would love like a faithful friend. Those were, at OTU, 2 arduous winter months. Course succeeded course, flying hours accumulated rapidly, aerial gunnery exercises over the snow-covered Welsh hills quickly mounted up in my pilot's logbook. Not without losses and tragedies, however. One of our Belgian comrades' Spitfires exploded in mid-air during an aerobatics practice. 2 of our RAF friends came into collision and were killed before our eyes. Then Pierrot Degaille, one of the 6 Frenchmen on the course, crashed one misty evening into an ice-covered hilltop. It took 2 days to reach the debris through the snow. His body was found in a kneeling position, his head in his arms, like a sleeping child, by the side of his Spitfire. Both his legs were broken, and unable to move, he must have died of cold during the night. The burial ceremony, with military honours, was moving in its simplicity. Jacques, Menuge, Comaille, and I carried the coffin, wrapped in the tricolore. God, how sad and weighed down we were under the thin, icy rain. The slow procession, one by one, before the pit filled with the sound of shovelfuls of British soil falling on the poor kid. After 5 weeks at Rednal, we spent the last 3 weeks of our training at Montford Bridge, a small satellite airfield lost in the hills. Without interruption, as soon as the weather cleared somewhat, we flew. Formation exercises in threes, fours, twelves, emergency takeoffs, dogfight practice, air firing, course on tactics, on aircraft recognition, on elocution for speaking over the RT, etc. The cold was appalling. We lived in Nissen huts, which had no insulating walls, and keeping warm was a real problem. I used to go with John Scott, the baby of our team, who shared a room with me, and borrow coal from a dump by the railway. John was very particular about his appearance, and it was a comic sight to see him, precariously balanced on barbed wire, passing greasy blocks of anthracite held distastefully between the thumb and forefinger of a carefully gloved hand. Then followed the Homeric business of lighting the diminutive stove which had the task of warming our hut. Pints of petrol, filched from the bowser, were necessary to excite the faltering enthusiasm of the damp coal and the wet wood. One fine evening, I remember, the stove, saturated with petrol vapour, blew up, and Jacques, John and I were transformed into Zulu warriors of the darkest hue. New Year's Eve came and went, very quiet and slightly sad in that remote corner. Then came the day of posting. Comaille, Menuge and I were to leave for Turnhouse in Scotland to join 341 Squadron, Free French Fighter Squadron Alsace, then in process of formation. Jacques, John and Aubertin were leaving for 602 Squadron in Perranporth. The die was cast. The real war was beginning. At last. The Alsace Squadron. Three young sergeant pilots disembarked in Edinburgh. The world was theirs. They glanced absent-mindedly at the Princess of the North, bathed in sunlight, though she had adorned herself with a resplendent snowy mantle. They were very tired. They had just crossed the whole of England diagonally from south-west to north-east, an exhausting night in the train with changes in the dark, jostling on damp platforms, mist forming halos round screened lamps, the panting of engines, the thronging crowd of uniforms. "The train for Leicester, please." Dazed by the noise, dragging their heavy kit bags, they had vainly searched for seats in crowded coaches with people sleeping on top of each other. Smell of soot, of sweat, of stale tobacco smoke. The coaches had started moving. Then the alarming, syncopated wail of the sirens. "Air raid on! Lights, please! Lights, please!" The jamming on of brakes, the hiss of compressed air, the impact of the buffers jolting the dazed passengers, thin blue lights extinguished. A quarter of an hour, half an hour, 1 hour of cold and silence, a few flashes in the sky, the distant hum of engines, vague gleams of light on the horizon showing up for a moment the silhouettes of factories or chimney stacks, then the sirens again. All clear. A blast on a whistle, the squeaking of rusty chains, more jolts, the engines skidding and racing, vague impressions drowned in an exhausting and uncomfortable twilight sleep. The bus stopped in front of the airfield guard room. Miraculously, all fatigue disappeared. "Turnhouse," cried the conductor. We saw great hangars camouflaged with green and brown stripes, the low buildings of the messes, the wooden dispersal huts scattered round the big tarmac runways, which quartered the grassy surface of the ground. A few aircraft here and there. The SP corporal on duty examined our papers, our identity cards, and had us escorted to the sergeant's mess. Slightly cold greeting from the station warrant officer. "French squadron? I haven't seen anybody yet." Good heavens. Perhaps it was a ghost fighter squadron. We began to sing a different tune. A utility truck deposited us with our baggage in front of a big, gloomy building. Dead silence. A smell of mildew, a large, empty dormitory, iron beds, small grey cupboards. Not a soul about. The first impression was disconcerting. Where was the cosy, animated squadron bar? Where were the gay, noisy comrades whom our imagination had showed us greeting us with open arms? Nom de Dieu, on ne peut pas dormir tranquille ici. The voice made us jump. An honest-to-goodness French voice, and from Paris, judging by the accent. And right at the far end of the room in a dark corner, we made out a shape, lying on a bed and smoking a cigarette. Navy blue uniform, gold buttons, a Frenchman. He got up languidly. Why, it's Marquis! We looked at each other and laughed. We four were 341 Squadron. The days passed and the Alsace Fighter Squadron took shape. Commandant Mouchot, one of the first to join the FFF, was to be in command. A tall, dark, slim man with piercing eyes and a voice that snapped and admitted of no argument, but was followed by a warning, friendly smile. The kind of man for whom you get yourself killed without discussion, almost with pleasure. Commandant, capitaine, lieutenant, sous-lieutenant, adjutant, sergeant-chef, squadron leader, flight lieutenant, flying officer, pilot officer, warrant officer, flight sergeant. Then Lieutenant Martel, who was to be my flight commander, a blonde giant with broad shoulders and enormous feet and magic hands that handled a Spitfire with incredible power and flexibility. Lieutenant Boudier, Boubou, a little wisp of a man behind a big pipe with a heart of gold. He was an ace, with 7 Jerrys to his credit already. He commanded the other flight. Then the pilots started arriving one by one. From the 4 corners of England, after tearing themselves away from the 4 corners of occupied France to come and fight. A natural selection brought about by willpower and patriotism. Every social class, but an elite. De Bourda, under a gay and carefree exterior, hid the tragedy of the loss of his best friend, killed at his side near Dieppe. Bourgeois, a stiff-necked Breton. Farmont, bearer of a name famous in the French air arm. Chevalier, calm, coldly determined. Lafont, one of the veterans of the GC1 in Libya. Girardon, one of our rare regular officers, full of banter and dry humour. Rouze, who hid his bashfulness and his kind heart under a surly exterior. Maté, who had crossed the Pyrenees on skis to join Free France. Savary, the poet of the party, subtle and cultured. Bruno, an experienced pilot, and a wag. Galit, his bosom friend, also a veteran from the heroic days with the GC1 in Libya. Pabio, from the Île-de-France squadron, who just wanted to continue the fight. Gradually the team built up, and still they continued to come. De Mezzeli from Brittany, who had lost an arm with the Lorraine squadron in Libya, and by an incredible effort of will, had learnt to fly with his artificial arm. Beru, the steady type of the gang, a sensible and studious pilot, whom you always went and consulted before you did anything silly. Laurent, meticulous, scientific, enthusiastic. Maillefer, that priceless practical joker. Le Guy, another Breton, as phlegmatic as any Anglo-Saxon. Raoul Duval, hero of sensational escapes, a regular to his fingertips. Born, friendly, self-effacing and discreet. Bouillon, Bouy-Bouy and his pipe, to his friends. De Sax, a walking skeleton who feared neither God nor the devil. One fine day, with a noise like thunder, our Spitfires arrived. Our English fitters took them over and we cleaned them up. Lorraine crosses appeared on the fuselage, with the markings of 341 Squadron N and L. Under the energetic leadership of Mouchot, and thanks to the experience of Martel and Boudier, the team of friends became a redoubtable combat formation. The planes were incessantly in the air, shooting, combat formation, dogfight exercises, scramble practice. The British were amazed at how fast the unit got into shape and generously admitted that it certainly was an exceptional one. 1 month later, the Alsace squadron was posted to the Biggin Hill wing. It was an honour. How great an honour we did not perhaps completely realise at the time. Biggin Hill, south of London, was the base with the highest number of victories to its credit and was reserved for the most select squadrons of the RAF. To go there, we were to be equipped with Spitfire 9s, with Rolls-Royce Merlin 63 engines, with two-stage superchargers, British Aero Technique's last word, parsimoniously distributed to a few outstanding units. To celebrate the event suitably, we threw a monster party for the turnhouse personnel, from Group Captain Guinness, the station commander, to the last mechanic. I watched Mouchot in a corner, looking very calm but a little bit sad. I knew what he was thinking. He was wondering with bitterness in his heart how many of the kids in his squadron would survive to the end. Death had already struck. De Mezzeli had been killed last week when the wings of his Spitfire folded up in a dive. And only the day before, Comay and Artaud had crashed, the wrecks of their two aircraft interlocked during a combat exercise. My first big show over France. We were still in readiness. All was calm in the Biggin Hill sector, and the morning wore slowly on. Wrapped in blankets, the mechanics lay drowsily under the dew-covered wings of the Spitfires. Time was hard to kill. In a corner of the dispersal hut, a gramophone was grinding out an old favourite, while Martel, Maillefer, Girardon, Laurent, Bruno, Gallet and I played a desultory game of Monopoly. Outside under the window, Jacques and Marquis, covered with grease, were fitting an enormous engine to a motorcycle frame, which they had dug up God knows where. The telephone rang. Everyone looked up with tense faces. "Early lunch for pilots. There's a show on," shouted the orderly from the booth. A very important sweep must have been laid on for early afternoon, and the mess was preparing a special early lunch for the pilots taking part. Mouchot had been warned and arrived at once, together with Boudier. "Martel, detail your section. You provide red 2, and Boubou will provide red 3 and 4. We crowded round the board, studded with 12 nails on which would shortly hang 12 metal Spitfire silhouettes, each bearing a name. The squadron battle order was posted after a few moments' discussion between the two flight commanders. Commandant Mouchot, Lieutenant Boudier, Sergeant Chef Bruno, Lieutenant Martel, Sergeant Romlinger, Lieutenant Pabiot, Sergeant Klosterman, Sous-Lieutenant Bourgeois, Sous-Lieutenant de Borda, Lieutenant Berrou, Sergeant Marquis, Sergeant Maté, Reserve, Sergeant Chef Galli. Those left out muttered restlessly among themselves. Rendezvous in the intelligence room at 12:30 hours. Mouchot went off in his Hillman utility with Martel and Boudier, while the other pilots piled into the mess truck. Quick meal with the pilots of 611, soup, sausages and mash. You could feel a certain apprehension in the air all the same. For most of us, this was our first big operational flight, and it would probably take us far inside the enemy zone. I felt very nervous. I was curious and anxious at the same time to know how I would react in the face of danger. A rather morbid wish to know what fear felt like. Real fear. The fear of man, alone, face to face with death. And yet there remains deeply rooted the old scepticism of the civilized human being. The routine of work, travel in comfort, the humanities, city life. All this, in truth, leaves very little room for a realization of mortal danger or for any testing of purely physical courage. However, I would have liked to get right inside the mind of that Canadian from 611 Squadron, whose first operational flight this was far from being. He calmly asked the WAAF waitress for a second helping of mashed potatoes while I was having difficulty in swallowing my first. And Dixon and Bruno, discussing football without pause, what were they thinking about deep down? It was at that moment, by association of ideas, that a certain Thursday at the Croix Catalan came back to me. I was keeping goal for my school football 11, Notre Dame de Boulogne. The Albert de Mont, centre-forward, a hefty chap who must have weighed at least 12 stone, had caught our backs off their guard and slipped past them. There was only one way of preserving my goal intact, to dive at his feet. Instinctively, I hurled myself forward with arms outstretched. Then, a fraction of a second before getting my hands to the ball, I twisted sideways. I was frightened of getting hurt by the studs on my opponent's boots. I was frightened, and the goal was duly scored. Ought I to be dreading a purely physical reaction of the same kind this afternoon? This sudden glimpse into the past finally killed my appetite. It was
sample complete. Ready to continue?